B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who once successfully convinced our receptionist that even par was a Swedish pop star, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. You know, last week was the Solheim Cup. This is, for lack of a better term, if you did not know, the LPGA's Ryder Cup, featuring players from America versus players from Europe. It was an amazing, captivating exhibition of golf. I didn't expect to get as into this as I did, but by Sunday afternoon, I was screaming at my TV like it was the Ryder Cup on steroids. Today, we are going to deep dive into this event from two different perspectives. One who covered it, Ron Cyrak of RonCyrak.com and the Golf Channel, and one who participated and shone in the event, Brittany Altomare of Julie Inkster's Team USA. Also, we'll catch up on where we are now on the PGA Tour with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, but let's get started with a past recipient of the PGA of America's Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism, Ron Cyrak. Ron, your joy and enthusiasm for this event, we were just talking, was palpable in your writing and your reporting, beyond the fact that you admire the participants and you follow and you cover the LPGA more than anyone I know. This just seemed different to me. Specifically, what was it about the Solheim Cup, this Solheim Cup, that captivated you so, or am I just misreading the room?
Now, you know, as a writer, you always root. People ask me, who do you want to win? And I always say, I want the best story to win. The best story won, and the best story won in the most dramatic way possible. The last stroke made on the last green by the last player on the golf course determined the outcome. You know, she makes it, they win. She misses it, they lose. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. And the quality of play for all 3 days was off the charts. I'm absolutely off the charts. On Friday, the first day, looks like the United States is going to go down 5.5, 2.5. They rally in the afternoon, 4 balls, and they have two matches. The last two matches, they have them. They trailed all day. They have those matches, and they make it 4.5, 3.5 instead of 5.5, 2.5. Saturday was some of the most brutal weather I've seen at a golf course, at a golf tournament. It was the winds were steady at about 25 to 30, gusting to 40, and morning alternate shot. Marina Alex and Morgan Pressel, they won 2-1. They played 17 holes 2 under par. 2 under par is hard to do an alternate shot in good conditions, let alone horrible conditions. Afternoon 4 ball, Suzanne Pedersen made 5 birdies in 6 holes in 30-mile-an-hour wind. So it's 8-8 going into Sunday. We go to Sunday, 5 matches go to the 18th green, 4 more matches go to the 17th green. It could not have been closer.
Even leading up to the start of Friday, the buildup getting to it, there just seemed to be a really, I don't know if this is the right word, a positively congenial atmosphere that I'm just not used to seeing or hearing reported about at these international matches.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think, and you really felt this when it was over, the Americans were disappointed. They were very disappointed. But everybody realized this was good for women's golf, and it was good for women's sports in general. I mean, it was the quality of play, the closeness of the competition, the intensity of the crowd. There were 90,000 people there over the 3 days. 90,000 people. You know, I went out to the first tee on Sunday, probably 2 hours, hour and a half, 2 hours before the first group went off. The bleachers around the first tee were full, and the fairway was lined 10, 12 deep from tee to green. It was stunning to see that many people on the golf course. Even more impressive was on Saturday when the weather was so bad, and still everybody was out there. 90,000 people turned out over 3 days. That's phenomenal outpouring, and the players responded.
Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com and the Golf Channel is our guest, Taking Dead Aim. I think one of the things that wrote me in, especially by the afternoon matches on Friday, is that, and for better or for worse, I don't know if this is a statement on my not keeping up like I should with the LPGA or on the fact that, you know, it's just sort of the way it is. I didn't know half the players on both sides at all. Like, I was really struggling to remember, oh, did I know her in college or things like that? And it was really great to sort of see these ladies, see their game, and more importantly, to watch them compete and sort of to see, okay, is this something these girls can build on moving forward?
That's a great point to make, because this was a changing of the guard Solheim Cup for both teams. Look who wasn't there for America. No Christy Kerr, no Paula Creamer, no Michelle Wee, no Brittany Lincecum, Brittany Lang, Angela Stanford, Jarena Pillar. And who were the stars of this? Jessica Korda and Nelly Korda. Both went three. They both won 3.5 of their 4 points. Brittany Altomare played absolutely great golf. You look on the other side. Celine Boutier and Georgia Hall went 4-0. Charlie Hall got 2.5 points. We saw people, young, talented golfers who were going to be the mainstays, the centerpieces of the Solheim Cup for the next decade. You know, this is probably the third generation of Solheim players. It was that group in the 90s, you know, the Laura Davies and Betsy Kings and Julie Inksters and Beth Daniels, Nancy Lopez, who carried it through. And then we went into the 2000s, and we had somebody like Suzanne Pedersen, who played a bazillion of them, and Annika Sorensen and Sophie Gustafson. And they're all gone now. And we've got a new generation out there. And this event's speaks very, very, very well of the depth of young talent in women's golf right now and where women's golf is going to go next. I do think this was potentially a breakthrough moment. I feel any news organization who wasn't there might have missed the story of the year. This could be the sports story of the year, this Solheim Cup.
I'm biased because I've been her pro-am partner twice when she was on the Symetra Tour. She's a frequent guest on the show, and we're friendly in real life, and that's Brittany Altomare. I was just blown away by how well she played and the gutsiness that she showed out there. And, you know, a couple of years ago, she had a chance. She lost in a playoff at the Evian, and I thought she was going to break through with her first win and her first major, and it just seems she's just been real close to breaking through, and I think she's one of these players. And the Korda sisters have broken through to a certain extent, but I want to see some of these American players build upon confidence gained at this Solheim Cup and moving forward, instead of wondering if they belong in the room with some of the top players on the LPGA Tour, to know beyond the shadow of a doubt that they belong in the room and in the final round and in the pairings with these girls.
I think all 24 players who were there, the players on the both teams, who were for the most part young, and I mean, even, you know, I mean, Morgan Pressel was the oldest player in the American team at 31 years old. You know, Pedersen was the oldest on for the European. She's 38. All the players who were there are going to build on this. This is going to be a growth experience for all of them. I expect to see breakthrough performances from all of them going forward. Altomare can flat out putt the golf ball. Man,
she's a birdie maker, isn't she?
She led the team coming into the Solheim, and I didn't know this. Inkster pointed it out to me that Altomare is 12th on tour in birdies. She had 277 birdies going into the Solheim Cup, and that was the most of anybody on the team. She is a birdie. If you put the ball on the green, you know, Altomare hits two kind of putts. They either go in or they almost go in. You know, everything she strokes is around the hole. And you look on the other side for Europe, I mentioned Georgia Hall. I mentioned Boutier. I think Carlotta Singanda is somebody with enormous talent who's like, she's sort of the Matt Kuchar of the women's tour. You can write T6 down next to her name every week. She's always in contention, has not won as much as I thought she would, but you might see her building on this and becoming a consistent winner out there.
She sort of had an up and down start to her career, and I say that, you know, my God, I think we first saw her in a Solheim Cup when she was like 12 or 13, and that's Charlie Hull. Charlie Hull has now matured into a really good, competent women's professional golfer. It was good to see her. I thought she played really well, and, you know, we're familiar with Bronte Law from playing college over here. Bronte Law's a big-time gamer.
Yeah, you know, there were on both teams, there's a lot of attitude out there. Charlie Hull and Bronte Law have as much attitude as you could possibly want. That's what Suzanne Pedersen brought into the team room. That's why she was made a captain's pick by Katrina Mathieu, because of her attitude. And then you look on the American side, Danielle Kang has attitude. You know, she's somebody who's going to go out there and annoy the other team, you know, get in their heads a little bit. But I saw Bronte Law play absolutely great golf this year. You know, all the Brits went into the Women's British Open, and that's all the Brits. I mean, Charlie Hull, Georgia Hull, Bronte Law all went into Sunday with a chance to win that golf tournament. They lost to some magic by Shibuna, the Japanese woman. But again, the depth of talent out there right now is staggering, and the performance that they put on at Glen Eagles was as good as I've seen. This is my eighth Solheim Cup. I've done seven Ryder Cups. I've done 174 major championships, men's and women's combined. This was as compelling, as engrossing, as entertaining of an event as I've ever been at.
Ron Cyrak of RonCyrak.com and the Golf Channel, our guest taking Dead Aim. There may not be two people I like or admire more in golf than Julie Inkster and Nancy Lopez. This wasn't Julie's first rodeo as a captain. She knew her job. But Nancy, it seemed to me through social media and whatnot, she did an amazing job at keeping it fun and loose, especially for the first-timers at this event. Was this a conscious effort on her part? Or, you know, shoot, was this just Nancy being Nancy?
Well, it was Nancy being Nancy, but it was also Julie being Julie. Julie created her pod system, and each pod had one of the assistant captains. Pat Hurst, Nancy Lopez, and Wendy Ward were in charge of each of the three pods in there. And that their job was to get to know, to get to entertain, to lead through their pod through this experience. And Nancy is just, Nancy will, she'll cry at a gasoline commercial. You know? she's an emotional person, you know, and she's a good person to have. And that's what, before every session, and I was on that first tee for the start of every session, the two foursome sessions, the two four balls and the singles, all five sessions, Julie would gather her three assistant captains together, plus her fourth surprise assistant, which was Stacey Lewis, because she had to pull out on Tuesday with a back injury. She'd gather them all together, and they'd have a group hug. And you'd see them standing up to the side of the first tee, hugging. And you knew that's what Julie and Nancy and Pat, all three of them are moms. And they sort of brought that mom feeling into the team room. And that mom feeling was tough love, but love. And part of what Julie did when she took over, the first year she took over as captain, she said, you know, I'm not a big fan of face paint. I'm not a big fan of fingernails painted. I'm not a big fan of cutesy celebratory dances after you win a hole. So she gave all of her players a lunchbox and a work vest and said, your job is to work. Go out there and work and let your golf do your speaking for you. Let your golf be an expression of your passion for how much you want to win. And that's what her team did. I mean, they went, she did it three times. They went 2-1. And the one she lost is the closest in any team event I've ever seen. So I think Julie brought to that team an ethic that was grounded, solid, off the charts. And in her three captains, assistant captains, Nancy Lopez, Wendy Ward, and Pat Hurst, she had three other women who bought into what she was selling, and they sold it to the players.
These matches, based on the inexperience or perceived inexperience of the American side, were way closer than I thought they'd be. In fact, you know, watching on TV until the last 15 minutes, I thought we had the dang thing won. As such, and based on what you just said, I get the idea you're giving an overall grade pretty high to Captain Inkster, even in a losing effort.
Yeah, I don't think she did anything wrong. You know, I think that Morgan Pressel played very, very well as a captain's pick. She got waxed in singles. But she and Marina Alex did really, really well in foursomes play. You know, her other captain pick was Stacey Lewis, who got bumped because of injury and was replaced by Allie McDonald, who did well. You know, I don't think any of her pairings were bad. She might have got let down a little bit, and it's not her fault, but, you know, the best player on her team, Lexi Thompson, did not have a good week. You know, she didn't play as well as you would have liked to have seen her step up and take over a leadership role, and she didn't do that. Now, she had some back issues on Sunday. Julie said the back issues had nothing really to do with the way she played. But I think Julie did everything well. You know, in Des Moines 2 years ago, the United States beat Europe pretty decisively, but Europe played really well. They just ran into a buzzsaw. The Americans played out of their minds. They played unbelievably good. And I think this time around, it's 13.5, 11.5. The United States is ahead. All they need is a half point to keep the cup. There are three matches still on the golf course. You think there's no way the U.S. is going to lose. Well, one of those matches was Pressel was getting waxed by Nordqvist pretty well, so that was going to go. But the other two matches were dead even, and Europe won them both. Bronte Law won, Suzanne Pedersen won, and that's just – and those are two of the most intensely passionate players on the European team. Julie did nothing wrong.
One thing that surprises me, Ron, or has surprised me, is it's become sport at Ryder's Cup and President's Cup, is the second guessing of decisions and things down the stretch. And there didn't seem to be a whole lot of second guessing. And on Inkster's part, I get that. But I really think, and I may be wrong in this, and please tell my family, I think that there deserves to be some second guessing on Marina Alex's part in this respect. On the 18th hole, she puts it in the middle of the fairway. Her opponent is in the rough. Her opponent has to lay up. At some point, you have to look at things and say, you know what? I'm a professional golfer. I'm at the Solheim Cup. I'm going to take a hybrid or a fairway wood, and even if I can't get it on the green, I'm going to get it as close as I can to ensure myself of just chipping up to a certain point to ensure birdie. By Alex making the decision to lay up essentially to the same yardage as Pedersen, she acquiesced an advantage that she had gained off the tee, and I haven't heard anyone second guess her at all about that. And all I could think is, okay, if you're an American player, if you're you know, a young American, let's say you're, I don't know, Justin Thomas, and you're playing Sergio Garcia in that same position, and you're in the middle of the fairway, and Sergio is in the rough, and you choose to lay up, that's the only question you're getting asked in the press room.
You know, I think one of the advantages Europe has over the United States in both Solheim Cup and Ryder Cup is they play more match play over there. And they make the mental adjustment to match play better than the Americans do. You know, they know you got to be more aggressive in match play than you do in stroke play, because aggressiveness usually doesn't hurt you. The worst that's going to happen is you're going to lose one hole. You're not going to make a triple bogey. So I do think that was probably a case where Alex played it more like she would in a stroke play tournament than a match play tournament, where, you know, in match play you got to try to take that gamble and do it. You know, that said, you know, I saw very, very few bad performances, bad decisions.
Oh, no, no. And I'm not saying it was a bad decision. It seemed to me in that situation you were acquiescing an advantage unnecessarily.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And that's where I said that, you know, you got to know that in match play, you got to be more aggressive than stroke play. Because, look, if Suzanne Pedersen misses that putt in stroke play, we're going to a playoff. But in the Solheim Cup, if she misses that putt, they lose. They lose on a 14-14 tie because the U.S. is the defending cup holder. There's a part of, like, you know, Marina might have been going after that hole with more of a stroke play mentality than a match play mentality. You know, gotta take advantage of what you have and get there. And I mean, that hole, that's a par five that for pretty much anybody in the competition, if you drive the ball in the fairway, you can get there in two. And Suzanne didn't do it, you know, and but they both ended up hitting their approach shot from pretty much exactly the same spot.
Get you out of here on this. Ron Cyrak with RonCyrak.com and the Golf Channel, our guest, Taking Dead Aim. You mentioned Lexi Thompson. If there was anyone who had what can be described as a disappointing Solheim Cup. It was Lexi. She was our most heralded player. She's the number three ranked player in the world going in. Is this a case of, and, you know, we forget because Lexi has been a part of this game for so long that Lexi is still, what, 25 years old? I mean, it's insane how young she really is. Is this a situation where perhaps Lexi Thompson, for the first time being put in that position of being the man on the team, that she may have put too much pressure on herself?
It could be. You know, I mean, on last Monday, going into the event, Golf Channel asked me, you know, who has to step up for both teams? And I said Lexi Thompson and Carlotta Singanda. You know, both teams were looking for who's going to be our horse, who could possibly play four matches. Who's going to be the one who goes out there and says, I'm not going to lose? And I said it needed to be Lexi for the U.S., needed to be Singanda for Europe. And it didn't turn out that way. Now, again, as you said, Lexi's still young. You know, this is still a learning experience for her. She could go. I mean, sometimes we forget. Players are starting at such a young age. Now, Annika Sorenstam didn't win her first tournament until she was 24 years old. And she won 72 tournaments and 10 majors. So there's still a long path ahead of her. But I do think that she was thrown into that role of where she was supposed to be, if not the verbal leader of the team, she was supposed to be the leader of the team by winning, by going out there and winning. And she didn't perform that standard.
From RonCyrak.com and the Golf Channel, that's Ron Cyrak. More on the Solheim Cup from Team USA's Brittany Altomare a little bit later on. But up next, Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer takes dead aim at where we are now on the PGA Tour, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Ron Green Jr. is an award-winning writer with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, frequent contributor to this show, and we haven't had the chance to catch up on the PGA Tour since the Tour Championship a few weeks ago. Ron, before we talk golf, we need to talk important things, which is, of course, summer movies. And something that you saw that I'm very curious about because you gave it a high mark, and that was the Springsteen music movie, Blinded by the Light, and you really liked it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm no movie critic, and I go to about three a year. So let's see, I've seen Rocket Man, the Elton John movie this year, and I've seen Blinded by the Light. And yeah, I mean, Blinded by the Light was great fun. I mean, admittedly, I'm a huge Bruce Springsteen fan, so I was predisposed to like it. But yeah, that was it was a pleasant surprise. I never thought they could concoct a song and dance number to Thunder Road, but my horizons have been expanded.
I got one for you along the same lines. Look, I like everybody else, I like the Beatles. They're not my favorite group in the whole world, but I know who they are, and I respect their music, and, you know, they're fine. Everybody needs a Beatles album in their library somewhere. But if you haven't seen it, you've got to see the movie Yesterday. It is fantastic.
Well, I meant to go see it, and that was sort of giving me the musical triumph. With Bruce Springsteen's Western Stars movie/concert coming out to theaters later, that would have been another one this year. Yeah, I got to check and see if Yesterday is on demand yet so I can go see it, or so I can watch it, which would also give me a merciful break from plowing through Breaking Bad, which I never watched, and I'm about a third of the way through, and might need a little goodness and light to break it up here.
Yeah, people who look, I've seen all of Breaking Bad, but I didn't binge watch it. I watched it, you know, a week at a time when it was out on AMC. And with people who tell me they binge watch Breaking Bad, I look at them like, how are you able to do that and still wake up and feel good the next morning? I mean, after about an episode and a half of Breaking Bad, I need to go shower.
Yeah, we did three episodes in one night the other day, and it's like, man, I'm looking for the Hallmark station.
Where's the Christmas movies when I need them? Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, an erstwhile movie critic, is our guest taking dead aim. We have not spoken
since the Tour Championship. We spoke the week of, but not after the Tour Championship. First, I wanted to talk with you about something that pops up, and it only, thank God, only pops up maybe once or twice a year at the most, but every time it happens, it's absolutely frightening, and that is safety of patrons at professional golf tournaments when you have electrical storms. I mean, I'm amazed that we don't have more injuries, because when you get, 50,000 fans out there on a golf course, and all of a sudden they're told to take shelter, there's not a whole lot of place for them to go, and weather rolls in, and my gosh, that was scary what happened on the 16th hole.
Yeah, I mean, that's why they try to get those weather warnings up early and give people time. Excuse me. I mean, they're serious. I mean, obviously, that was just terrifying what happened in Atlanta there. And you can go way back to fatalities on golf courses from lightning storms to the U.S. Open years ago, as I recall. It's nothing to play with. I mean, we sort of get used to lightning being around here, but just through the summertime and everything, and as soon as it starts popping, or you get a sense of that, I start going the other way. I mean, we waited out a thunderstorm here recently at our club, and it's like some guys were thinking, you think we can go back out? I'm like, give it plenty of time. I'm in no hurry. And I mean, it's because the golf course is so expansive too, and obviously most people don't get to park right there, so where do you go? And that's always been a huge problem, and that's why, again, as I said, tournament officials try to give a long lead time when they sense something is coming, but sometimes you just get caught in difficult situations, and that, I mean, fortunately it was not worse. It could have been a whole lot worse than it was, but it's just, we know how dangerous it can be, and then you get just sort of the firsthand experience or whatever right there, and it just, man, that was terrifying.
I'm sure that it's written on the back of a ticket, and whatever happens, happens, and it's on you. You and I both know that's not worth the paper it's printed on. What is the tour's liability in something like that? Is that something that they're even concerned with?
Well, I'm sure they're concerned with it. I would not have any idea what their liability is. I'm sure they have themselves protected some way. And yes, I think if you get hit with a golf ball at a tournament and all those sorts of things, I think you sort of accept that risk when you walk out there. But yeah, I think, certainly they want to be as proactive as they can in helping tournaments get people to safety when storms blow up and, come in and, but we know people who always think, it's not that bad. Let's just wait it out right here. This thing will pass. Well, it may, but it may not. And it may be a one in a million shot, but that one is the one you don't want it to catch you there. So yeah, I don't. I think it's just when you see those weather warnings, if you're at a golf tournament, pay attention. And they can play more golf. You can wait it out. You can go do something. Get away from there, because I think that's something, it remains fresh with a lot of people and should for a long time.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. More fireworks at the Tour Championship was the play of one Rory McIlroy, who topped off a what I considered a very, very good year, a very, very consistent year with the Tour Championship and the FedEx Cup and $15 million and whatnot. But I was, I got to tell you, I was really surprised, and I'm sure you're going to talk me out of being surprised, that he won the Player of the Year from the players' vote point of view. This, to me, is a seismic shift in the way players are thinking about majors. Were you as surprised as I was, or am I just living in the past here?
Oh, I was surprised, and I think it was abundantly clear from the little video with the trophy presentation that Rory was very surprised by the thing. He even said so. I don't know that it's a shift in how players look at major championships so much as it might have simply been a popularity contest. I mean, Rory had a great year. The Players' Championship and the FedEx Cup are two huge achievements. He won Canada as well. But I think if you put take the money, the $15 million out of it, put two blank pieces of paper in front of players and say, which season do you want? 90% of them are going to take Brooks's, I think. But I think, everybody loves Rory. The consistency was a big thing. What is it, 14 top 10s in 19 tournaments? And beating Brooks at the end at the Tour Championship sort of got back what he didn't get at the WGC event in Memphis. But I think I think, in fact, I had a fairly prominent player tell me, said, a lot of guys didn't like that Brooks said, you know, I really don't practice that much. When a big tournament's coming up, I start grinding on it. But, you know, I just kind of go play. I practice once in a while. And that, he said, hit a lot of players the wrong way. Was it enough to influence the vote? May have swayed some because, I mean, again, this is a blind ballot. Nobody sees who votes for who. We don't know how close it was. My sense is it was probably very close. And I feel almost certain that Brooks Koepka will win the Golf Writers Award for Player of the Year when our vote comes up later this year, like he won the PGA of America Award.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think it, part of it speaks to how much guys like Rory, too.
Well, but it's not as if Brooks is a villain. I don't get the idea. I mean, I see what you're saying. That one comment may have rubbed some people wrong, but it's not like Brooks is eating alone in the locker room. Brooks has friends on tour, and Brooks appears to be fairly well-liked in his own right.
Yeah, I think he is. I mean, I don't know that he's the guy who goes out and cultivates friendships, but he's got his sort of group he stays with, but I think every player pretty much has that, whether you're Rory or Snedeker or Kuchar or whoever. I think that's the way it is. But I was surprised. I would not have guessed that was going to happen. I think, you know, I remember before the Tour Championship started, Rory was asked the question, if you win this week, does that put you in the Player of the Year conversation? And he said, well, I suppose it could. But, you know, he sort of acknowledged that he thought what Brooks had done had been enough to lock down the Player of the Year thing. And you know, I'm a huge fan of Rory, as most of us are. But I think when I get my vote for Player of the Year for the Golf Writers, it'll go to Brooks.
Yeah, see, I mean, I'm the same way. I really, you know, look, I love Rory McIlroy. I could get lost watching his swing day in, day out. But I just, you know, I look at Koepka's season and, you know, had a WGC event, won a major, finished in the top five in the others. But the big one, the two stats that stand out to me that really separate him from Rory McIlroy are, number one, in the three majors in which they both competed on the weekend, Brooks beat him by like 21 shots. And when the lights are brightest, if somebody beats you by 21, they just had a better year. And the one that Rory missed is the one that really ices it for me. If you're Rory McIlroy and you're from Northern Ireland and you're one of the people that has lobbied and campaigned for and been a champion for having the Open returning to Northern Ireland, you can't go out and spit the bit like that. You just can't. That's not what a Player of the Year does. And that was the overriding thing for me.
Well, yeah, I mean, that certainly, you know, as good as Friday was for him, I mean, that Thursday was really, you know, sort of changed the tenor for a while of that whole championship. Obviously, Shane Lowry came back and turned it back into this big celebration. But, I mean, how about the simple thing that Brooks Koepka finished in the top four of all four major championships this year, winning one of them? He's only the fourth player to ever finish in the top four of all four in one year. I mean, Tiger, Jack, and Jordan Spieth have done it. I mean, that's something that you can't say it never happens, but it rarely happens. And that, I thought that's what separated Koepka. I mean, and winning, you know, he forced the issue, you know, forced Woodland to beat him there at Pebble Beach. I mean, he'd love to have a swing back at 12 at Augusta on Sunday, but so would Francesco Molinari and Tony Finau and some others. But, you know, I just think I would not have thought there would be much debate about it, but I was surprised again.
Ron Green's here with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. Well, last week we turned the page. It's a brand new season, the 2019-2020 PGA Tour season. And another young player that we've been expecting to break through for a while broke through. I mean, this summer we had Morikawa, we had Wolf, and I mean, you know, I remember 2 years ago at the U.S. Amateur at Riviera watching an epic match between Braden Thornberry and then number one amateur in the world, Joaquin Niemann, that was just fantastic on Riviera's course. And I knew the moment he turned pro, he was going to be something. And he's been someone who's been making checks and making good money, but it was good to see him break through. And that's just yet another one of these great young players out there, Ron.
Yeah, I mean, he's only 20, and yet it feels like he's been around for a while, you know? I mean, I guess because he was number one amateur in what you were talking about. And I mean, he's a guy who doesn't have any sort of glaring weakness, and he got overshadowed a little bit by these other guys who've gone out and won tournaments, but I think he finished like 68th in the FedEx Cup. I mean, had a really solid year. Again, I mean, he's 20 years old, and to hear guys who've been around him talk about him. I mean, they speak glowingly of his game and personality, and you know, I think there was such a focus, you know, on Victor Hovland and on Colin Morikawa and Wolf, that it was easy for Niemann to sort of get in the shadows there for a moment, but now he's stepped back into it. I mean, you got this foursome of guys, and, you know, if Cameron Champ, who's almost a year removed now from winning, Sanderson can find what he had then, you got yet another guy, and who knows how many more coming along, but it has been, I mean, it's just been this sort of transfusion of really young, exceptional talent that has arrived, and I think as we see this, you know, this fall schedule play out a little bit, I think we're going to see more of them, and it's going to be interesting. Well, Niemann is not, I think Niemann has played his way onto the Ernie Els Internationals squad, but it'll be interesting to see if Wolf or Morikawa might factor into Tiger Woods' decisions when he comes around to getting his last four players.
Thank you for bringing up Tiger Woods and his last four players. Get you out of here on this. This week, or maybe it was the end of last week, cryptically, Tiger Woods changed the listing of himself and the President's Cup team from captain to playing captain. Are we to take it that there are now three spots available for captain's picks?
Well, I don't know. He didn't really change now. I proved that I had not been reading the captain's blog on the website when I made a little tweet about it like other people. I have only to immediately be told by his camp, hey, he's been signing all his blogs like that for a long time. So it was not new. But, yeah, I mean, I told somebody else, I said, I don't think playfulness is the first thing we think of when we think of Tiger Woods, especially when he's talking about international competition. So is he just being playful with it? I don't know. I still have a hunch he's going to play in the President's Cup. I think obviously how he does when he goes to Japan next month is going to have a huge, is the big variable in that, how he feels. Personally, I want him to play. I think, you know, if you're going to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever to watch him play over there, I think having Tiger Woods on the golf course is a little more incentive to do that. Nothing against the obviously great players who are going to be there, but I think, you know, that's the big question. I mean, he's got there's a lot of potential players to fill these holes, that there are more good players than there are spots. You know, I mean, we talk about, is it Patrick Reed? Is it Tony Finau? Is it Gary Woodland? Is it Ricky Fowler? You don't even mention Kevin Kisner, who I would love to have on a Masters League team if I'm picking a side. You know, Tiger Woods, you know, then you throw these new guys in there. It used to be you'd think these were fairly easy decisions a lot of times, but I think he's got a lot to weigh. He may not have a lot of bad answers, which is a great thing for him, but you know, if he picks himself to play, of course he's going to get a lot of blowback from people who think, oh, yeah, you never should have done that. But I think just as – there'll probably be just as many people saying, of course, he's Tiger Woods. You get the chance to have him on your team, and you want him to play.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. And when we return, back to Scotland and taking dead aim at the Solheim Cup with Team USA's Brittany Altomare, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Hey, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I first met Brittany Altomare as her two-time Pro-Am partner when she was on the Symetra Tour. Just a few short years later, she's a standout star for Team USA at the Solheim Cup last week in Scotland. Brittany, there's so much I want to talk with you about. First off, even though it was on paper a loss for the American side, in a lot of ways I thought it was a victory. For ladies professional golf, for American golf in particular. And I think that so many people got to learn who you were and what your game is all about. And so rather than console you, I want to start off by congratulating you on what I thought was a really, really, really good week last week at the Solheim Cup.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much.
So let's start at the very beginning, and that's when you get over there. And I was so happy. It looked like we initiated the pod system, and the vice captain in charge of your pod is only one of my favorite people in golf, in sport, in the world. If you find me one person on planet Earth that doesn't love Nancy Lopez, they need to get off my planet. So tell me about that system, the girls in your pod, and how it was with, you know, a Hall of Fame legend.
Yeah, I mean, I just realized last week how amazing that pod system is because, you know, for somebody like me who's not super outgoing and, you know, I mean, I do okay in big groups, but I'd much rather small groups. I mean, it's a fantastic system because, you know, you're with three other girls that have similar personalities and, you know, it makes the team a lot smaller. So I feel like, you know, you do your practice rounds with them, you eat lunch with them, and, you know, you form special bonds with those girls too. And to have Nancy as our pod leader was very special. You know, she's super funny. She, you know, we had a group text message going, and, you know, she caught on to all the jokes that were going on, and she was always laughing and, you know, just making us feel super comfortable, which, you know, she did a great job of.
You mentioned, you know, the group of girls, and having been around you and watched you out on tour, how many of these girls that were on the Solheim Cup team, and I use that term, ladies, that were on this Solheim Cup team, how many do you really know personally before the Solheim Cup? How many of them do you hang out with on a regular basis, and how does that go for the rest of the team? Or was this really a group of girls, ladies, you know, 12 of you or whatever, that really hadn't spent all that much time together before last week?
I think for the most part, I didn't know all of them super well. But, you know, when you're in a team environment like that and you're spending every second of every day together, I mean, you get to know everybody on a deeper level, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, because even on tour, even the girls that are my friends, I still don't spend as much time with those girls as I just did with those 11 girls that I played with last week. You know, I mean, like I said, you eat breakfast together, you practice together, we did everything together. So, you know, you get to know them. Yes, it's a short amount of time, but I feel like you get to know them personally, like, really quickly. And like I said, the bonds and the jokes and everything that you formed throughout that week is just, it's so special. And I think that next week when we play in Indy, the girls that are there, I mean, that bond just keeps growing, and so hopefully we'll continue to go to dinner and hang out together and stuff, because last week was very, I mean, it was cool.
One of my golfing heroes and Solheim Cup putting legend, Brittany Altomare, is our guest taking Dead Aim. I've heard golfers talk about that first tee shot at the Ryder Cup and how completely nerve-wracking it is, and it's unlike anything they've ever experienced before. Brittany, you've been in playoffs for major championships. You've played in U.S. Opens as an amateur. You've had nervous experiences on tee boxes before. What was it like? You were the second match out on Friday morning in the foursomes playing with Lexi Thompson. What was the atmosphere on that first hole like? What was the feeling going through you before you took your first shot?
You know, all the veterans are saying, like, even in, like, the Solheim team stuff we had before that last week, that, you know, like, the emotions that go through you, I mean, it's just everything. And I think they're right, and it's something that you can't really describe, unfortunately, because it's the coolest feeling in golf, I think. But for me, I mean, I was a little nervous, but I think for me it was more of an adrenaline feeling, you know. I mean, it was so cool. We had a lot of U.S. fans there, which I thought was amazing for them to come over and support us the way that they did. And they were sometimes even louder than the European fans, which I thought was really cool. And, you know, they came up with their chants and stuff, and to hear your name being chanted and like, cheering for you that loudly on the first tee, I mean, there's literally nothing like it. And it just makes you want to get on more teams, which is my next goal.
Brittany, what is Lexi Thompson like? She seems, you know, a lot of us just know her from her presence on social media, but we don't really, and she's been in the game forever. I mean, you know, I was talking with Ron Cyrak earlier, and I mean, I feel like we've been talking about Lexi Thompson forever, and she's only 25 years old. But what is she like as a person? What is she like off the course, and then what's she like to play, you know, 18 holes of golf with as a partner?
Yeah. you know, Lexi was somebody that, like you said, I feel like I've known her and played with her for a really long time, but I never really got to know her. And it was cool to be in her pod and to get to know her on a different level, because, you know, I see her at the golf course and we've played golf before in tournaments, but you don't really get to talk or get to know each other. And she's awesome. She's funny. She's down to earth. She, like, jokes around. I mean, even in the practice rounds, she was very upbeat, lighthearted. You know, she had music playing for the nine holes on her phone. I mean, I was very surprised by that, and I was very happy to get to know her that way, because, like I said, she seems different when you just look at her from the outside, but I really appreciated to get to know that side of her. I mean, she was a great partner. You know, she said to me before we walked through that tunnel, she was like, you know, don't worry about this tee shot, just go hit it, you know, just feel like, embrace it, just hit it. It's just like any other tee shot. And I think having somebody like that on my side made that tee shot so much easier.
You didn't come through in the end against Georgia Hall and Celine Boutier, but I got to tell you, I was encouraged. Because you lost 2-1, but Brittany, I watched you lip out two putts on the back nine that were dead center. I mean, 2 inches from the cup, they were dead center, and they lipped out on you. So you had to feel like the golf gods were going to, you know, give you a little bit of satisfaction a little bit later on in the day. And sure enough, they did. What an unbelievable match that afternoon.
Thanks. Nellie and I, we didn't really get off to a super good start. Like you said, I mean, I looked at a few in my morning match, and then it kind of continued into the afternoon. I had a putt that says par on a par 3, I think it was the fourth hole or something, and it literally did more than a 360 around the cup. I was like, you know, I'm hitting my putts where I want them, at the speed I want them, you know, eventually they're going to fall, and eventually they did. So it was nice that Nellie and I could come back from four down. I definitely did not want to lose two matches in a row, so to get back to all square, I mean, it was huge for me, but it was also huge for the team.
Yeah, no, it was an awesome, awesome, awesome finish. The Korda sisters seem to be having an unbelievably good time throughout the whole Solheim Cup experience. I mean, if anyone did not look nervous, it was Jessica and Nellie Korda. Are they similar in personality, or are they different? What is your experience with them?
I think a little bit of both. I mean, they're both pretty funny. They joke around and stuff. But they also are different, I think, at the same time. You know, I mean, but it's amazing how close they are, and it was nice to see. And, I mean, they play alternate shots. I mean, they killed it in the alternate shot together. I mean, and like Jess kept saying, like, there's nobody that knows each other's games better on that team than they do. And I think that was a very smart move by Julie to put them together for alternate shot, because they're just so comfortable with each other.
Brittany Altomare is an absolute putting icon and Solheim Cup player, and she is our guest taking Dead Aim. You mentioned about alternate shot. I wanted to ask you about that. It's one of my favorite formats to play with certain people. I love to play it with my son because we know each other's games so well. I have a really good friend, and we play it very well. But in both instances, our games are very different. Do you think it's better for alternate shot to have the same kind of game, or, you know, not so much?
I think it could go either way. I mean, you know, Lexi and I obviously have very different games.
Yeah.
You know, I stepped in the first two with my pod, and I was laughing because I said, well, I'm definitely the shortest hitter by a mile on this group. And I think Nellie's caddy goes, it's okay, you put like Jesus. So, I mean, you know, in that golf course, it kind of set up where there really was a strategy for alternate shot, because if you had teed off on the odds, you were driving the ball more and putting more, whereas if you teed off on the even, you were hitting way more approach shots. I mean, I ended up playing the odds, and I didn't get to hit an approach shot till number 8. So I actually think the back golf course set up for best ball where two games might be different. So, you know, because to me, Lexi is a phenomenal iron player. And, you know, I don't think it really bothered her hitting my drive, because she was still hitting shorter clubs than most people would hit them to, because the course was playing long and it was playing wet. So, I mean, I think it all depends on the golf course, to be honest with you.
You mentioned hitting approach shots and not having one until the 8th hole. I was playing an alternate shot with my son at Mid Pines earlier this summer, and we were rocking and rolling along pretty good. And then all of a sudden, he hadn't had to hit like a wedge in 7 or 8 holes. And all of a sudden, he had a feel wedge shot, and it, you know, it threw him off. Is that tough for you guys as well? If you, it's hard to get in a rhythm sometimes playing alternate shot because you're literally not playing some shots that you normally would on a regular basis.
Yes and no. I think, you know, I tried to just, I told my caddy, and because then we help each other with yardages and stuff, and so I would just want to know, like, you know, what's her yardage into the hole. So I would try and stay thinking throughout the whole time so that when it was my turn to hit an approach shot, I was already kind of thinking that way. But, I mean, it is hard, you know, and I'm sure it was hard for Lexi, you know, because she wouldn't putt for a while, and then to get the speed right on the putt that she had was probably hard as well. So, I mean, but it's fun because I think, you know, it's the truest form of team golf in golf that there is, and I think that's what's most fun about alternate shot.
Brittany Altomare is our guest taking dead aim from the Solheim Cup, and she's my golfing hero. You sat out the Saturday morning foursomes. It seems like everybody sat out a match, so, you know, that's just what you need to do. You probably needed the rest, especially after the emotions of that that Friday afternoon match. But you came back Saturday afternoon in the four ball, yet another new partner playing with Annie Park, and got a point for the team, a big one against Suzanne Pettersson and Ann Van Dam, two players who were great for Europe in the Solheim Cup this time.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Annie, I've known Annie for a really long time because we're both from the Northeast, so we grew up playing junior golf together. And Annie and I worked really well together. We, you know, when I wasn't playing great during the game, she was playing great. And then when I was playing great, she, you know, so I thought we hand and egged it really well. And, you know, obviously we came out with a win, which was really exciting.
A lot of people talk about the team room at these team events, whether it be with the men, the President's Cup or the Ryder Cup, and with you, the Solheim Cup. Going into that team room on Saturday night before the Sunday singles, I think in a moment of honesty, if they'd have told you guys the previous Monday morning, hey, look, by the time we get to Saturday night, it's going to be 8-8 heading into the singles, you guys would have taken it and said, let's go ahead and play this. What was the atmosphere like in the team room that night? What were some of the things that are going to make it special for you remembering that?
Yeah, I can't really remember, but I just remember, you know, everybody was really excited because I thought we had pretty good momentum going into Sunday. You know, Danielle made that putt on 17 to close her match out, and Annie and I, you know, closed our match out on 18, and I thought we had pretty good momentum going into Sunday, but we all knew that it was going to be close. I mean, both teams are playing phenomenal golf, and it had to be close, and you know, for it to end the way that it did, yeah, it was a very tough loss for us. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, Suzanne made a fantastic putt on the last hole, and, you know, that match was close all day. And as I keep saying, we all knew it was going to be close, so.
Brittany, I want to ask you about Sunday. Two things in particular. First, your singles match. And I sent you a text after it was over. I was like, oh, my God, 5-4. That's what I'm talking about. That's getting it done. Was that almost a surreal thing for you for this to be your first Solheim Cup, your first singles at the Solheim Cup, and you just went out? And, I mean, you didn't just win. You won with an exclamation point. That had to feel fantastic.
Yeah, I was done. I knew how to go out, and I had to make a lot of birdies. You know, like I said, everybody was playing well, and I did that. And that was to be like all three of my matches before that went to 17, 18, and I just wanted to close my match out fast as possible because I felt like I had played a lot of holes. But, you know, Julie said in the team room on Saturday night, she was like, you know, if you get up, you can't get comfortable. You know, you have to keep pushing, which, you know, Asa and Charlie were 4 up on Nelly and I, and, you know, we came back and tied them. So, you know, I just kind of kept that in the back of my mind, just, like, keep pushing. It's not over till it's over. So I just tried to keep pushing, and, you know, I was lucky enough to close it out on 14.
Get you out of here on this. Solheim Cup player, my golfing hero, and putting icon, Brittany Altomare, is our guest taking dead aim. It was nerve-wracking on TV in the States. I can't even imagine what it was like for you guys. I don't know if I've ever seen a match that literally flip-flopped from one side to the other in less than 15 minutes. In less than 15 minutes, the Bronte Law and Ally McDonald match flipped, and then you had what happened with Marina and Suzanne, and it was over. I mean, it was. We went from I was sitting there going, "We got this thing won! Holy cow! If we could just, you know, if Ally can just have this par three with Bronte, it doesn't matter. We're going to go 14-14, and we're going to retain the cup." And then it flipped, and it happened so fast. I don't know. It had to be overwhelmingly deflating. Yes.
Yeah, it definitely was. You know, it's hard for me though because I told them on TV you get to see more than what we do. And I was following Ally's match, and you know that was going back and forth, and so I didn't really know what was going up on 18. I was with assistant captain Wendy, and you know they have radios, and they're radioing back and forth, and it was like, you know, Marina hit it to 12 feet above the hole, Suzanne hit it to, you know, 8 feet, blah blah blah. So. And I was getting the updates as they were on the radio, but I was following Ally's match. So, yeah, it all happened really quickly. And I saw we were on 17 green when Ally finished, and we turned around, and Suzanne was about to putt. So, yeah, it just all happened so quickly. But, you know, like I said, it was going to come down, you know, one hole or one putt because, you know, everybody was playing so well, and it was just so close all week.
Yeah, get you out of here on this. This was something that I mentioned. We talked with Ron Cyrak earlier, and he mentioned this, and I kind of got the vibe watching this as well. We're so used to watching the blood and guts of the Ryder Cup, and there's been some testy Solheim Cups in the past. There was, I don't even know if this is the right term, Brittany, there was such a congenial feeling of respect between the two teams that and even though, you know, you lost, it was as if both teams kind of sensed that what you guys did last weekend, I think, was really good for the ladies' game. And it was almost as if both teams kind of celebrated in a way. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, we all know that what happened last week was amazing for women's golf. But, you know, at the end of the day, we did lose, and, you know, it was a bit, I don't really know the words to describe it. It was a deflating feeling a little bit, you know, at the end. But, you know, I think the next day when I woke up and I saw all the tweets about, you know, how great this was for myself, like I realized, you know, at the end of the day, it was something special that happened last week. You know, win or lose. But, you know, obviously you always
want to
win. So.
From Team USA at last week's Solheim Cup, that's Brittany Altomare. I'd also like to thank Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, and Ron Cyrak of RonCyrak.com and the Golf Channel for their time and insight this week. A reminder, you're just catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered? No worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BPod Studios, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there now, links to articles on the latest goings-on in and around the game. Hey, weather-wise, a fantastic weekend with plenty of opportunity for teeing it up and letting this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart here in the Carolinas. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.